Hi there. Have you been a little bored listening to some of those podcasts lately?
Listen, I hope you're not in the car right now with some kids. Because I'm about to drop some F-bombs. This ain't your average fucking podcast. Music.
We like this cow. It's kind of one of those things, it's like a duck. You know, you see a duck in the water, right? The duck looks like it's cool, but the duck's freaking working hard under the water. Wow, working hard. That's how our place is. We look cool, but we're working hard.
Welcome. You are now listening to the Duck Legs Podcast. We are physical therapy students here trying to bring you raw, honest, and ultimately funny material while we interview the experts of our field.
I was brought up listening to Smodcast, Kevin Smith, and Nerdist, man. I was brought up listening to comedy podcasts. So when we were thinking about making a physical therapy podcast, I was like, we're going to make a comedy podcast that happens to talk about physical therapy.
Exactly.
Welcome to the Duck Legs. All right, y'all. We're back. We have a loaded episode today. We got Lisa Maczora. Did I hit that name right?
You did.
Nice.
You call me Lisa Mac and Cheese.
That, I will definitely call you Lisa Mac and Cheese. Lisa Mac and Cheese is on. We also have Edwin Porras.
Close enough. We'll roll with that.
How do you say it, man?
Porras is fine.
Edwin Porras. And Lisa Mac and Cheese, if you've been on Twitter in the PT world from Twitter, you probably recognize that handle. And if you're like me when you're new to Twitter, you probably thought she was a physical therapist or somebody in a healthcare professional, but she's not. She's a patient, correct?
Yeah.
Right. And if that doesn't blow your mind of how active she is in the PT world, almost being an advocate for PT and for patients in general, it's just amazing to read her tweets and to see how active she is inside our quote unquote healthcare space. And we have the privilege of talking to her thanks to our man Edwin from St. Mary's. And what year are you?
I am just wrapping up my first year, man.
Just wrapping up your first year of PT school. Congrats.
Hello, Edwin.
Thanks. Just two more to go, right?
they'll fly by.
What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I keep telling myself. We have a comp exam actually coming up in May, and a little nervous about that. It's supposed to be over our first three semesters, so we'll see how that goes.
You got it. And of course, we're also joined by the legends, Trace McClintock.
What's going on?
Yeah.
And the legendary Super Saiyan, Tyler Adams.
Yeah. Charging up over here.
All right, y'all. Man, Lisa Mac and Cheese. So it's weird because like I know you. I know a little bit about your story, but I don't know the full story of you as a patient and how you came into physical therapy. So if you're comfortable with it, do you mind kind of summarizing how you came to be this force in social media in the physical therapy space, being a patient?
The elevator speech? Okay.
It doesn't have to be elevated. It can be longer than that. It's a podcast.
Well, you can riff off whatever I say, whatever you think is interesting, and I'll like, try to expand, but I don't want to bore people to death. I'm 53. I'm from Philadelphia, more or less, and I have spastic cerebral palsy. I had physical therapy through Easter Seals as a small child. I was diagnosed at about a year and a half, which is an eternity when you're a kid. Didn't walk till I was about three or four, had physical therapy through Easter Seals and then through a prototype school for disabled kids and normal kids. Was sort of half and half. And I graduated, so to speak, in second and third grade from being full-time with the special ed kids on the special ed wing with the PT to the side of the school that was for normal kids. That was called mainstreaming. I don't know what it's called now. I think most disabled kids or many disabled kids are more integrated more initially maybe than I was back then. Keep in mind, this was the late 60s, early to mid 70s for my elementary school years. And then at 11, I was told that, you know, great, you're up and walking. You're done, basically. You know, in one way, shape, or form, I was told, you know, you've basically graduated. And I'm 11, you know, and I'm walking, but I'm walking poorly. Various braces, canes, and hardware over the years, and they said, you're done. And so from 11 to 45, I got no PT at all. My doctors, including orthos over the years, told me that there was nothing they could do for me, and I didn't understand that what they meant was that they couldn't do anything surgically for me. And because I had received PT as part of school and as pro bono through the Easter Seals, because we were working class, I didn't really understand when the doctor said, there's nothing we can do for you anymore. You've sort of maxed out on your ability to improve. I didn't realize that that didn't mean that PT wasn't going to help, because I assumed the doctors and the PTs were working in concert. And so I just assumed I was farmed out, left to pasture. And, you know, for about 10 minutes, that was exciting, because you think, oh my God, no more exercises. Fantastic. And then you realize that you've been sort of abandoned. And so I didn't get PT again until I was 45. And you can imagine walking on two legs that are spastic, that I lost time. I lost functional time, to say nothing of the psychological toll that that makes. And then I had, when I moved to Arizona, I had low back pain and got hooked up with Eric Christensen at Chandler PT in Chandler, Arizona. If you want to call it the luck of the draw, that you could call it that, but I seriously think it was providence, because I don't know that another PT would have picking me on, because he's ortho and I'm neuro, and a lot of ortho PTs will tell you that they're not scared of neuro, that they treat everyone, but they really don't tend to want neuro because they think I'm more complicated, which in one way I am, at least on paper, but in other ways I'm exactly like ortho in a lot of ways. It's just that my ortho issues are ramped up because of the neuro issues. So, and I've been with Eric for about coming up on 8 years now. It'll be 8 years in August. We work on a variety of things. Some strength, a lot of balance training. Flexibility is a big issue. My big thing is that I've got to keep working. I work full-time in a regular job. And I have a mortgage, and I've got to pay that and all my other bills just like everybody else. And I need to keep working in order to be able to do all that that, you know, you do as an adult. And
all the adulting things.
Yeah, I'm not real fond of the adulting term.
No.
Yeah. It's like the people who tend to use that are already adults.
Mm.
You know, I've told Edwin, it's like, okay, if you're 18, you're an adult by law. I'm going to treat you like that. Just because you're in school with an enormous amount of debt doesn't mean that I'm grading on a curve in terms of your emotional maturity. And I think sometimes, as much as I love the students, you know, all of them, I love them. I think sometimes they think, okay, well, once I'm out of school, then my adult life can begin. You know, your adult life began at 18. You're just a student through the first part of it.
Yeah, it's real easy to not feel like an adult yet when you're still in school.
Yeah.
Even, you know, grad school. I definitely am guilty of that.
Yeah, one of the things my stepfather said to me years ago, this was as I was graduating with a bachelor's from Temple University, he said something very funny, which is not quite true, but funny all the same. He said, congratulations, Lisa, you now have the ability to incur debt.
Ooh, yay.
And I was like, yeah.
Thanks.
Right. Well, that was back in the day when I wasn't eligible for a credit card until I was 25, because they didn't have the same banking rules that they don't now. Or lack thereof. So that's kind of where I am right now. I'm early onset aging, even though CP is not supposed to be progressive. A lot of people put that in quotes and say, well, it's not neurologically progressive. That was one of the big beefs I had with what I was told and not told as a kid, and even as an adult, is that nobody told me this was going to get more difficult. Because from 10 to 24, I had no assistive devices at all for walking, okay? And at 24, I started to get more tired and more tired and more sore and more wobbly. And I mean, at 53, I have the bones of an 80-year-old because I have severe osteoporosis, which was not addressed early. And I'm walking around with a rollator where I didn't used to need that at all. or anything like that for a very long time. So there's that. And that's kind of where I am right now. And I'm trying to get hooked up with a lot of the students because I'm seeing a lot of support among some graduated PTs and you know, older adults. And by older, I mean 30. But there are a great many of PTs out there that I think are maybe a little angry and a little annoyed at the fact that I will call them out on anything that I think is important and anything that I think is detrimental to how patients are treated by PTs and anything that interrupts the therapeutic alliance. So there you go.
And what are some of those things? Have you been called out in the past before for your statements?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I won't name names, but I was told by somebody on Facebook that I had no right to comment.
What?
Yes. Hold on. I had no right to comment on how PTs treat patients in terms of the therapeutic interventions. I'm not talking, you know, social niceties. I'm talking therapeutic interventions. That I had no right to comment on therapeutic interventions to a PT because I wasn't a PT and I needed to quote, and I'm quoting, stay in your lane. I was like, you know, I'm Lisa Mac and Cheese. Have we met?
You know who I am?
Yes, you know who I am. You know the great power I supposedly wield.
Do you know the power of the cheese?
Exactly.
This is some powerful cheese over here.
We've got to make that a new hashtag.
and call me. Now, as Tyler and I like to say, we are still just mere dumb students. But Tyler, wouldn't we say that Lisa Mac and Cheese is most certainly a part of therapeutic interventions because she is a patient?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's non-negotiable there.
Yeah, you guys don't get a vote.
Oh. You know,
I'm, to quote Lin-Manuel Miranda, I'm in the room where it happens.
Ooh.
You know?
I wish I saw Hamilton or I would quote more Hamilton stuff at you.
Seen him out. Yeah. See them here at ASU a couple months ago. It was worth every freaking penny.
Yeah.
I lip synced almost the whole thing.
That is
quietly,
awesome.
Of course.
Phil, if you ever need to feel like, you know, busting out some songs from Hamilton, feel free to do that.
Maybe, you know, the second round of Zoom, we could
do. Yes. It'll just be Lisa Mac and Cheese version of Hamilton, a solo performance.
With you guys doing the
this
slow
is really
clap.
Impressive.
With you guys doing the slow clap.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. And I'll throw you one more question before we turn over to some other the other guests. But I was curious to learn of, you know, you said it wasn't until 45 that you got introduced to physical therapy or reintroduced. What led to that?
Back pain from too much sitting at work. I have a full-time desk job. And it was getting painful, and I didn't know what to do about it. I was sure I'd need a brace because I listened to commercials just like everybody else. And
commercials can be good.
Depends, not usually. And I went to a spine center, saw a back doc. They sent me for an MRI, which I know drives you guys all nuts, and now I understand why. But after my MRI came back and I was completely clean, my spine was fine, they said, you need PT, and they gave me a list of PTs, and Eric was convenient to me. And then the miracle occurred. So.
Look out, Edwin. Look out. There's a train.
A train? Yeah. That's not something.
I think we lost Edwin. But Lisa Mac and Cheese. God, that's a great name.
You can just shorten it to Lisa Mac.
Lisa Mac. The train kind of messed with my train of thought there.
Oh.
It was just, the train was highlighting my point.
It was. It was like that scene in movies when, like, the intensity and the pressure and the adrenaline goes up, and then you hear that train come back, and then all of a sudden, Michael Corleone shoots that guy.
I never knew my father. Yeah.
Yeah.
Guys, I just want to apologize for all the noise that's going on. I'm trying my best to keep quiet. I'm just going to mute myself. I'm just listening. And if you have anything to say to me, just go ahead and shoot your question, because I live literally right next to the train tracks. And then, as you noticed, everything in my apartment is amplified times 3 to the power of 3. So I'm just letting you guys roll with it. I'm just going to hang out here, and I'll try to stay as quiet as possible. Sorry about that.
Edwin, you just hop in when it's safe, all right? Are you okay?
Sure. I am safe.
Okay.
I'll mark my face so I can safe, okay?
Good. Let us know.
Sure.
And we'll keep checking back in with you, man.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
But Lisa,
I'm here.
I'm sorry, Tyler.
No, I was just saying that's got to be tough to like sleep at night with the train that close to you. Like, hell of alarm clock.
It's they're not on like a consistent schedule either, and so it just goes back and forth. And some of them will just pull that horn that you just heard, and they'll just hold it forever. And yeah, it's I'm trying to get used to it. It's not quite happening though, so we'll see.
Come on, Edwin. They're trying to get the cow off the track, okay?
Yeah, exactly. Something like that. Gosh.
And this could tie into like, you know, this might be a forced tie-in, but when we talk about accessible cities and cities designs and health-oriented cities, like Lisa Mac and Cheese's great blog post on the APHPT website, when she took a trip down to Philly. And she was remarking on how easy/difficult it is to operate a city. And would we say that train tracks next to homes, probably not the most ideal city design?
I would agree.
Yeah.
The tracks came first.
So the weird thing about my apartment complex, not to go off like on too much of a tangent, but yeah, I mean, so it is far from grocery stores. I will say that. And part of the reason is because they converted these complexes into apartments from, it was actually a stove factory, like a legit stove factory. And now they're called stove factory lofts, and they've made them into quote unquote luxury apartments, which I would argue that's a subjective term. But yeah, I mean, accessibility is everything. It's kind of ironic the fact that we do have, so we're on the fourth floor. We have stairs and an elevator available for us. But as far as, like you guys obviously just heard a minute ago, we have a train right next to us. And the closest grocery store is a couple miles. So interestingly enough, accessible and inaccessible in one.
Mm. And Lisa, did you move from Philly to Arizona for the accessibility benefits that Arizona had?
I'm a city girl, so I didn't move. I mean, I moved willingly, but I didn't move, you know, really happy about it. Using the subway got to be harder and harder. I got more tired and more tired, more energy expended. A lot of my friends were, you know, married and moving on from school and things like that. I went to school at Temple University. I did not see Arizona per se as particularly accessible. I knew it would be probably a decent place to age, but I didn't think I would have to worry about aging until I hit 65. It was, you know, it's a car culture. They're slowly dipping their toes into mass transit with trolley service around ASU, but that's by no means ubiquitous. It's 115 here in the summer very frequently, so I don't know that we're necessarily going to get a subway or a bus system that's as comprehensive as it should be. I don't use public transit here. I do drive. I have a regular car with regular controls. And I'm starting to learn how to use Lyft. But primarily, it was just the walking. But leaving Philadelphia was the walking and the walking and the walking and the stairs. And I just got more tired and more tired and more tired. And I left the year that the ADA was passed. And keep in mind that, you know, Philadelphia is older than the country, so
that's right.
It was not very accessible. It's better now. You'll have to read that article that I wrote for Mike Eisenhart and his team. I have a description of there how it was and the things I was worried about. And I literally trained for that trip for a couple of months with a DPT student who's now a DPT for the same clinic that I go to, Chandler PT. In Arizona, and we worked on balance. He was familiar with New York. My regular PT, Eric, you know, had never used public transportation in a regular way. So he didn't really have a sense of what it's like to be disabled and try to ride a train. Jake, the student then did. And so he would do a lot of balance training with me, you know, do things like try to push me over.
Yeah.
A lot of that, you know.
A lot of shoulder bumps in the subway over there.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Although, since I don't commute, when I was in Philly, I wasn't commuting for work, which would have been a different level of congestion people-wise. But I did all right.
Also, Tyler and I will jump at any chance to do like a Philly, New York style accent.
Yeah.
If you ever want to role play some subway action.
You're listening to a Philadelphia accent.
Yeah. So I didn't mean to be offensive.
No, you're not. Hey, I'm from Philadelphia. Yeah. I'm proud. If you guys think that's strange, that's your problem.
I don't even know the Philly accent. I guess I'm always drawn because we're from the South, so we don't know much about the North.
It's a cross between Italian, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania Dutch.
Okay. Amish.
Yeah. And I was talking to a customer on the phone. This was a couple of years ago, and he didn't know who I was. I'd never talked to him before, and he says, "You sound just like you're from Baltimore." And I said, "No, but you're close."
Yeah, I'd be curious for you to listen to just a tangent about, you know, it's definitely in the article about Philly, but the things in life that people might not perceive, they don't understand how difficult or that this process of climbing stairs is more difficult than what you would think. Just a whole tangent of like those types of things that other people might not be aware of.
Well, Jake Kelso and I were talking about this just the other day. He was subbing for Eric, who was off for a vacation day or something with the family. And I was telling him, I said, you know, normal people don't really have a good concept of how important personal space is for somebody who's disabled and ambulatory, as distinct from somebody who's in a wheelchair. Not saying that personal space isn't important for somebody in a wheelchair, but the considerations are different if you're ambulatory in any way, shape, or form. Because I have a lot of people, if I'm in a public space, who will go around me because they're faster, which is fine, but they go around me too close. And they don't hit me, but a lot of times I don't hear them. And so my reaction is to flinch. Mm. And I was trying to explain this to Jake, and I think he got it, was that, you know, just because you know you're not going to run into me doesn't mean I know I'm not going to run into you. Mm. I need a different level of personal space when I'm standing as opposed to when I'm sitting. When I'm sitting, you know, I want a normal amount of personal space that you would recognize as normal. When I'm standing, I want you at least 3 feet back, preferably 6, unless you're actually helping me ambulate, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because I have to know I'm not going to hit any people or things, and I don't want to meet the floor suddenly. And just because you know you won't hit me, like I said, just because you know you won't hit me because you're being careful doesn't mean that you won't scare the crap out of me. It's like, I mean, like 5 or 6 years ago, I bought an iPod back when the iPods were first out. Or no, it was a Nano. When the Nanos were big, I bought a Nano. And I was like, this would be great. I could download all my music. It'll be great for traveling when I'm, you know, on a plane or whatever. But I had to get rid of it. You know why?
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 I couldn't hear the ambient noise that I needed to navigate.
I couldn't hear
the people around me. I couldn't hear the voices. I need time to react. My reaction time is very good. It's just not always very productive. I need to be able to hear the people around me that are coming up behind me or around me in order to be able to position myself in a way that's safe. So
This is kind of a touchy question, but when is it the appropriate time, would you say, just some like basic guidelines of when you would like assistance from somebody, a stranger, somebody you know, helping you ambulate? You know, when is it that time to help someone, or do you run across a lot of times where you're thinking, hey, can I just get a hand real quick just for a second? Or do you run across more times you're like, leave me alone, I can do it myself?
Well, I tend to want to do things myself if I can. Mm-hmm. People will very frequently offer help, which I'm always careful to thank them for. And usually what I do is they'll say, can I help you with something? Like if I'm out of the store or whatever. And I'll say, you know, I really appreciate you asking, but I'm fine. You know, and
yeah.
Some people will take offense to that. Like I've gotten a few dirty looks. Usually people are just like, okay, great. You know, but every once in a while I get dirty looks like, you need my help. Like, of course, you know, like I was in an airport one time. I was going to Houston to visit my mother. And this man came up to me. It was crowded. There were lots of people around. And I was moving slow, but I was trying to stay out of people's way because it's the airport. And he came up to me and he said, you need a wheelchair. And he wasn't offering a wheelchair. Okay. And I said, no, thank you. I'm fine. Thinking he was just trying to be nice. No, you need a wheelchair. Like he was pissed off at me.
Whoa.
And I'm like, I'll decide when I need a wheelchair.
Wow.
You know, and I didn't say that, but I was just like, I don't have time for this kind of attitude. I don't want somebody other than my PT telling me when I need assistance.
People have some weird psychological stuff going on when it comes to that.
And also, and this may sound odd, but I've noticed it consistently, is I get less grief from people who are non-white. I get less grief and more help.
Huh.
And I have some theories about why that is, and I'm not sure that this is the place to talk about that. But
this is definitely the place to talk about it.
Okay.
Yeah.
If there was ever a place.
If you want to, I mean, I can go into it. It would just be my theory. I'm a white woman, so.
I will stop all trains from going if you talk about this.
Yes, Edwin.
He's out on the track with his hand up. Wait.
Exactly. Lisa Jeez is talking about race in the United States. You need to stop.
I mean, she only has Black Lives Matter, you know, on her Twitter banner.
Yeah.
And I have the sticker on the car. Not saying that makes me a better person, but I realized I was being an idiot for being afraid to put it on there.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go.
Because and the people that need to understand that Black Lives Matter are not black people, they're white people.
I'm mind blown by some of the things that you will say and then tag me in on Twitter. And I'm like, God, more people need to see this and hear this.
Anything you want me to expand on or explain on before we get back to the race issue?
There's a student question and you can talk about it again, but it kind of relates back to what you said about, you said, you know, most, I think I don't want to misquote you, something about patients are want you to succeed as a student.
Oh yeah, I was a little surprised at how that was misunderstood.
Well, I'm not sure if it was misunderstood. I think the person was trying to, maybe they're trying to understand how they can decipher whether a patient is hopeful or I don't know.
Well, everybody's got their public face, okay?
Right, exactly.
Completely. I mean, unless you're married to somebody, and probably not even then, you're never going to have somebody that's got their guard completely down.
Mm-hmm.
So just accept that. It's not a function of you. It's just a function of us as human beings. You know, I like working with students because I feel like it's a way to change the future.
Yeah, sure.
Students are generally speaking, not always, but generally speaking, they're more open to new ideas, and that they're more open to the idea that patients are people because they haven't had that idea beaten out of them yet, and I hope that they never will.
Right.
But your influence isn't just the people that you're going to be seeing in your clinicals. It's going to be everybody that you treat from the time you're a student in clinicals till you retire from the PT world and probably beyond. So a lot of people think, your target audience needs to be other patients. No, the patients can talk for themselves. I'm not worried about the other patients in terms of bonding with them. I need to sort of bond with the people that directly impact their lives and have people be aware of the influence that they have. That's yeah, sure, it's clinical, but it's also personal and social, and how you treat people from a psychological standpoint is often just as important or more important than how you decide to treat them physically.
Yeah, absolutely.
Edwin, do you know who asked that question?
Yes, so that was Larry Kennard. I'm not sure if I'm saying his name right. And it looks like he either goes to or graduated from San Diego State University. That was on the post I put up on the Doctor of Physical Therapy student page.
Shout out to Larry.
So Larry, yeah, well,
shout out to Larry. Good question. Thank you. I think he was concerned too about, you know, the if I remember right, he was concerned about the difference between wanting students to succeed and feeling confident that they would succeed. And
yes, like, exactly.
That's not my role as I see it. My role is not to parse out whether a student is or is not going to be successful in either treating me or as a PT student in general, or even as a professional. That's not my job. My job is not to decide if you make the grade. I know you guys are very grade oriented. When you're a student, it's hard not to be. But my job is to disseminate information that the normal course of PT, learning PT, is not going to give them.
Exactly.
I'm trying to make you guys better human beings in order to make you better PTs. And that may sound incredibly pompous, and it probably is, but I really feel like that's my role. I need to help you guys understand what it's like to be a patient and the ways that we're different from people that aren't patients, but that, you know, 95% of the time we're just like you.
And I absolutely agree.
If you lose sight of that, you're not going to be clinically effective. Clinically effective. I'm not talking about, oh, your no-show cancel rate or everything goes down. I'm not talking about they like you or they don't like you. I'm talking about if you can't effectively facilitate buy-in, as Jerry likes to call it, Jerry Durham likes to call it, then it doesn't matter how great your hand skills are or your other clinical skills are or how much you like CrossFit. It's not going to happen because they won't see the value in it and they won't come. Or if they come, they're just going to be like, and then do whatever they want. And the next time they're going to go to somebody else.
Totally agree. And thank you so much for, oh yeah.
Am I helping? I don't want to do
that. Yes, absolutely. Okay.
I think this is invaluable because so much of our PT education is from PTs. People that are, you know, academics and that are, you know, come from that side of it. And our only real experience with patients is during our internship. Some of us have more internships than others. So it's really nice to talk to somebody that's on the other side of the, you know, the therapeutic intervention, right? And it's way more valuable to hear, you know, that's cute, some of that stuff that you learned. It's cute in theory, but don't bring that to Lisa Mac and Cheese when we're sitting down.
I am going to call you out, and I'm not going to call people out just because I'm trying to be big man on campus or whatever. There are misconceptions about what patients think and what patients want, and I'm here to tell you where that disconnect happens. And a lot of people, this is a big beef of mine, I'm sure Edwin knows because he's listened to Dustin's podcast, Senior Rehab Podcast, of my interview in 2016. One of my big beefs is, like, people think, like, you know, neuro is this big, scary, hairy thing. And a lot of the PTs, that students and the new PTs that are coming up, it's like, I want to do CrossFit. I want to do ortho. Ortho is really my thing. Neuro is so complicated. Neuro is so different. It's not that complicated. It's not that different. You know, people want to make it different because it scares them. And I'm saying, you know, those things they call soft skills are the difference between what makes you a child and an adult. And if you want to call them soft skills and skip over them because this technical stuff that's, you know, more important in the gym is more exciting to you, you need to grow the heck up. Grow up.
How do you define soft skills, Lisa?
The ability to relate, partially empathy, the ability to ask good questions as to how the person's deficits impact their ADLs, not just their ADLs, but their life in general, their family life, their ability to function within a family, or if they have to, not function within a family. I'm single. I've never had a family of my own. And it's a different dynamic if you're living with someone and you can say, could you drag that out to the car for me, or could you pick that up off the shelf? And if you're living alone. Part of the reason I decided to go with PT in the last couple of years on a full-time basis, meaning I see him every week, is because I wanted to know that it was as much a psychological decision as a practical one. I wanted to know there was one person on the planet that would notice if I didn't show up once a week. You know, now my boss would notice, you know, because I have a job, but outside of my job, I wanted to know that there was one person with one eyeball on me all the time. And that was a psychological comfort for me. It's also safer because I wanted to be able to stop the worst of the injuries before they happened. You know, I didn't want to wait for a fall or for my hamstrings to start killing me before I signed up for another tour of duty at Chandler PT. I needed that social reinforcement as much as I needed his clinical skills, which are considerable. And just to make the point again, he's an ortho PT. He's been treating me off and on, mostly on, for the last 8 years. He's not scared. I don't know why other people should be. And you think about it, you know, it's like, oh, well, you know, neuro isn't my thing. I'm interested in other things. And it's like, hold on here. Let me appeal to your base self-interest. I'm chronic. There's only so much better you can give me. I'm always going to need PT. I'm a steady source of income for you. Whether you're an employee of a clinic or you're a clinic owner, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not going to, you know, sprain an ankle and then come back to you later for something else in 6 months. I'm going to need you pretty much all the time, or at least significantly more frequently than the average person with no built-in disability. So, you know, how do you like neuro now?
Love it.
Yeah. How do you like me now?
Yeah. And one of the quotes that I saw on your Twitter recently, that to tie this back into, if you want to say race and,
oh yeah,
and,
yeah.
And I'll say, able body privilege, which is, I learned that term in a women's and gender studies, ableism and how that's a real privilege. And just that's, you know, related to like when we're walking down the street, an able-bodied person, you know, how they make you feel kind of speeding down the street, you know, when you have your rollator and you're like, just because you think you're not going to hit me doesn't mean I don't know that. I think that that's clearly represented there. Mm-hmm. And the quote that you tweeted out was, don't talk to me about how great athletes are so motivated until you dial into what it feels like to be really, truly afraid of a curb, and also know that you don't have a choice but to kill that fear. Oh, that was such an awesome quote.
Yeah, that got some interesting response, you know, in terms of hearts.
Yeah.
Not so much commentary. Yeah. I mean, I think ableism is a thing. I'm not really fond of the term. I think sometimes people go looking for issues to be offended about. But it's absolutely completely a thing. And I find a lot of ableism among PTs, because the assumption is among a lot of PTs on Twitter, less so with people who follow me and who know me, is that the assumption is that, you know, you're just the patient in general. I'm speaking broadly. They're just a weekend warrior. They can rehab for a couple months and they'll be fine. And then, you know, maybe 6 months or a year down the line, they'll come back to me for something else. And it's like, this assumption that the baseline is even remotely close to normal is not a good thing. It makes the people that are significantly disabled, such as myself, feel like we're second-class citizens. Like, you know, we're an okay first date, but you wouldn't swipe right.
Mm.
And maybe not even then. You know, it's like, I remember learning to walk. You know, I remember it. And I remember how scary the idea of hitting the floor was. And that actually, when Eric was teaching me how to use the rollator on curbs a couple of weeks ago, we were literally standing outside of the clinic in his big high curb. And we could have gone down to the ramp, because there was a ramp. But since there was no ramp in my 1983 condo, I needed to, you know, learn it. And I was literally standing on the curb, and he's down at parking lot level. He's in front of me, and I'm crying, okay? I'm a 53-year-old woman, and I'm crying. I'm crying exactly like I cried when I was about 7 in my school's clinic, when my PT then said to me, okay, I'm going to let go of your hands now, and you're going to stand by yourself. And I felt exactly that emotion of like, I'm going to fall. Everything's going to shatter, and I'm going to be toast. And now I'm, you know, now I've got severe osteoporosis, so that break is going to mean a little bit more. So it was like a flashback to that feeling of I'm never going to be able to conquer this. But he didn't let me off the hook. He's like, you can do it. And after a couple weeks, I could. I'm still not graceful about it, but I haven't fallen, and I've been able to get a lot of work done. So.
Nice.
Yeah.
And you killed the fear.
I killed most of it, yeah. It's still awkward, but yeah, I had to beat it back. I mean, no one takes care of me but me. I think the assumption with people that are permanently and congenitally disabled is that they've always got somebody they can call up and say, please do this for me. And I don't. I mean, I have friends that can come and help, but not on a moment's notice. They don't live with me. I've always lived alone. You know. Does that help?
Oh, that was beautiful. Definitely. Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to get all girl on air.
No, that was awesome.
Yeah, I remember those feelings very distinctly, and they're completely terrifying. And they all came back to 2-3 weeks ago. Like, oh my God, I'm going to shatter. You know, but I didn't.
Gotcha.
To get back to what we were talking about race. Now, I'm an older white woman, so I could be completely off base in saying this, but here's my take on it. And I don't know how people of color would feel about this assertion, but I think there is some truth to it. People of color generally treat me with more respect than white people do. Not saying that white people in general are disrespectful. They're not. People are generally nice. I get some comments that are less than respectful, but I think maybe part of the reason that I get more props from people of color is that they know what it's like to be judged on how you look. You know, a snap decision, good person, bad person, interesting person, not interesting person, dangerous person, not dangerous person.
Yep.
Sexy person, not sexy person, you know?
Yep.
And I think I get cut a little bit more slack from people of color than white people because they know what it's like to be judged harshly and quickly. So.
That makes sense.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'd be interested to hear what kind of response you get on that thought from whoever listens to this. But
yeah, I totally agree, for yeah. one.
I don't
want to overstate it. It's not this. Like I understand what it's like to be a person of color. But that aspect of it, I can at least partially get because I've lived through it.
Right.
You know, I didn't grow up in a politically correct era. You know, I went to school in junior high every day. There were catcalls, sometimes things thrown at me. Nobody wanted to be my friend. I went through
what?
Yeah.
What grade was this?
Oh, well, through junior high, which was your middle school.
Just because of the way you walked?
Yes. Well, people would mimic me. Call me names. That happened a lot. And that wasn't unique to me. Any disabled kid would go through that. And there are a lot of people that get bullied in school. I'm not saying disabled people are unique in that regard. You can get bullied for almost anything. But when you're that visible, when it's not something you can hide,
yeah,
it leaves you feeling very emotionally raw, and it's very difficult to trust.
Yeah.
And so that's why my bar for physical therapists and physical therapy students is so high. I found a really good PT, and I'm well taken care of, and I have a circle of PT and PT student friends around me that understand where I'm coming from, and they appreciate the arc of my journey and my opinions, even though they may not agree with them. But that wasn't me coming up. And I need you guys as PT students and as, you know, eventually new PTs and older PTs as you get older, and more experience. I need you guys to understand this, because just because I got lucky, you know, after 35 years away from PT, and found a good PT who understood where I was coming from and wanted to help, a lot of people don't have that option or don't even know it's an option, because everybody wants CrossFit. Everybody wants to have that last post about the ACL injury. It's like, oh, I'm so freaking bored.
Yeah, it
do that something does. You're not good at. Try something you're not freaking good at. I made the last student I worked with, Jake, that guy I was telling you about, Jake Kelso at Chandler PT, who's now the PT there. I helped to get him hired. I'd like to think that.
Nice. I bet you did.
I tried. I try to plus one all the PT students I work with, if they can hack it.
The influence is so strong.
You know, I just went up to Eric with regard to Jake, and I've done this with other students too that have since graduated, and Eric's there was one other person that he hired. But Jake was the latest, and I said, listen, you know, you do what you want with regard to Jake, but I like him. And if that counts for anything, you should hire him as soon as you can.
That's awesome.
And he did. You know, I'm not saying I was the only factor. I don't even think I was the primary at all. But I'd like to think I had some influence.
Yeah. I bet
and
you did.
I you know what? Well, one thing I made Jake Kelso say when he first started treating me, I said, repeat after me, neuro is my favorite thing. And he did not say, he said it back to me because he knew he had to. I had him in a corner. He did not say it with great enthusiasm, but I think by the end of his clinical, I had convinced him that maybe neuro wasn't quite as bad as he thought it was going to be. And he actually, one time when, after he was hired, after he finished school, I worked with him one day when Eric was out, and I said, I want to do this, this, and this today because I'm worried about this. And he stops, and he looks at me, he breaks out in this big grin, and he says, I so missed working with you. I'm like, yeah, I love you too, Jake.
We can totally make shirts that says neuro is my favorite thing now and hand them out to some PT students.
My other thing, and I use this both in the PT world and in my work world, which has nothing to do with PT. I want a t-shirt that's made that says, I'm horribly biased, but I'm not wrong.
Yes. Well, we need to reach out to Andrew Tran over at Physio Memes and see if we can get some shirts made. Trace, how's it going, my man?
It's going.
It's going.
I was actually gonna ask. I was gonna ask. When you're having students, do you feel like you have to encourage them to like? So I worked with a kid with CP. He was 18, and the very first day when I worked with him, he was like, "Oh, there's so much I can teach you. Don't be worried that you're gonna break me. Like I'm not that fragile."
Right.
Do you, like, see yourself having to initially tell students that, because that was a huge thing, and I learned so much from him, because it's like. I came in thinking, you know, I knew a little bit about neuro, but I had never worked with that population. Mm-hmm. And that was like a big confidence builder for me, getting that exposure and feeling more comfortable with like everything.
It's true. I mean, like, I don't remember specific instances because it's been a while. I'm not working with a student right now, but I probably will be soon because Eric has somebody else that's coming on board soon. I don't really specifically remember specific comments I made to Jake or to Danny when they were students with me, but just basically like the big thing is anybody with CP, anybody that has a congenital and often a chronic problem is used to being handled. Oh my God, we're used to being handled. You know, and I know sometimes with guys, if you're treating women, it sometimes feels a little awkward because you want to be respectful of people's personal space and their body because, you know, it's just that's the way the world is. But it's like we're so used to being handled. Please handle me. Because what you communicate when you handle someone is that they're – and I explain this on two nobodies. Is that you're communicating to me that my body is not repulsive. Mm. And I've been told explicitly or implicitly a lot of my life that my body is repulsive. And, you know, now, obviously, if someone's gone through some sort of – you know, sexual trauma or rape or anything like that, you want to be sensitive to that. So I'm not saying disregard people's, you know, cultural issues or history issues entirely. I think you absolutely need to pay attention to that. But chronic people are used to being handled. And if you handle us carefully, and with a goal in mind, you know, therapeutically, I don't have any problem with, I don't care. Like air dry needles, my glutes and my hamstrings a lot of the time. And for the first few sessions back when I first got them done, I only get them periodically done now. It's not very common. Dry needling helps a lot with me as a CP patient because it takes out the spasticity. But you know, he's like, well, after a few times, he's like, well, do you still want a room? You know, and he wasn't like still want a room. He just wanted us to go into one of the prior treatment rooms. I was like, no, I don't care. You know, yeah, I don't want my whole rear end hanging out there, but I don't really care. You know,
yeah.
You know, we're all friends here, you know. Nobody's ogling.
We all know what this is.
Right. And I don't know if most PTs do this, but I noticed it with Eric, which I think is a good thing. Like, when he's working on my adductors, which are extremely tight and causing me lots of problems, I'm starting to scissor more, which is very difficult. When he works on my adductors, he doesn't look at them while he's working on them. You know, which I think even though I'm used to being handled, that would be awkward after a while if he were looking at my adductors while he's working on them. Because, you know, all my bits are up there.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't look at them. It's like he's, I don't know how to explain it, but he's feeling for what's wrong. He's not looking for what's wrong.
Gotcha. So he can have a conversation with you and stuff.
He's looking at the backside of the clinic and he's working and I'll tell him, okay, that really hurts and that really isn't too bad. And, you know, and one of the things I told Jake, and I don't know if a lot of people are like this, maybe this is just specific to me, Jake the student, back when he was a student. I told him recently when he was working on me, I said, well, that he was working on my adductors one day and I asked him to, because I knew they were tight and being obnoxious. And I said, well, that hurts, you know. And usually when I tell Eric that, Eric just keeps going, and I expect him to keep going. And so Jake, of course, being newer, would stop. And I'm like, what are you stopping for? And he's like, you told me it hurt. And I'm like, unless I pull away from you or tell you, please stop, don't stop working, I expect it to hurt. He's like, well, that's really weird. Like, okay, so maybe that is specific to me because, like I said, I'm used to being handled. It's like, I don't understand. There were PTs on there for a while, maybe a couple of years ago, who were saying, well, PT should never hurt. I should never have to hurt a patient. Well, isn't that just freaking lovely to think that you have that magic that you will never be able to hurt me, and if you hurt me, you're doing something wrong. Now, I'm not talking about injuring someone. I'm talking about causing, you know, brief temporary pain in order to accomplish the therapeutic goal.
Right.
I'm not talking about injury. I don't want anybody to injure me or anybody else. But, you know, I always thought that that was kind of a princess attitude, except that that would be an insult to princesses, you know.
Yeah, there's some interesting mindsets I'm sure you've seen online.
Oh, my God, a lot. It's just like, I expect there to be pain. I don't want there to be a ton of pain, and if there's more pain than I can handle, I'm going to tell you that, and you will have to stop. But don't just stop just because I say ow. You know, if I say ow, then stop. If I say ow, don't stop. You know, you're on the clock, and so am I. I'm paying for this. Get it done.
One of the PTs that I was shadowing at the VA actually told every single one of his patients that he was aiming for three specific types of pain, and we'd avoid three specific types of pain. So he's like, if you're getting a stretching pain or a muscle pain or the next day you feel pain, like all that, I want that. That's therapeutic. We're good. Mm-hmm. If you're getting things that are like sharp shooting pain or like a burning sensation or right at a joint line, we'll avoid those. But if it's not one of those three, then that's what we're aiming for. I really bought into that. So,
yeah.
I think that's an interesting concept. I'm not sure who I ripped this off from. I don't remember. I read a lot of blogs and tweets, but it goes along with I have shadowed some physical therapists who will be working with patients. And if they do something and the patient says, oh, at least they kind of like the pain you're talking about, you're like, oh, that kind of hurts. Ow. And the PT will be like, all right, let's stop. Let's move on to the next thing. And I mean, I didn't necessarily ever really think twice about that idea until I read something, said something along the lines of, if you tell your patient that it's okay for them to stop as soon as they feel any type of pain, then to a certain degree, we are feeding into fear avoidance and the idea that pain.
You're amping the patient up and not in a productive way.
Mm. Correct. Right. So that really made me kind of think about the idea of pain. And like you were saying, you know, don't stop if it hurts just a little bit.
Right. If it's just kind of like, I told Jake, I said, I am providing you with feedback. I am not telling you to stop. I'm telling you, you've hit the right spot, the spot you're trying to work on. But the other day, Eric, my main PT was working on me and he hit a spot and he really hit it. And I was just like, and this was after a while of him working on my adductor. And I was like, okay, I'm done now. And he knew I meant it. And we moved on to something else. I'm like, I'm done. I've had as much as I can handle today. I'm done. And he understands that. But like when I first, not so much early on, but when he and I started doing more strength training and with kettlebells and stuff like that, which is something that's difficult for me, but we've MacGyvered it. I didn't really have a good grasp of DOMS. I mean, I know that like runners say, okay, I'm sore the next day after I run, but I didn't really have a good idea of how much that happens and how normal that is. Because he was treating me for something, I don't know if it was mid back or low back one time, and we were doing some exercises for that or whatever it was. And the next day I was pretty sore and I thought, oh, geez, what did I do? Did I re-injure myself? And he had to explain to me about DOMS and how it's really okay. It's normal. You didn't re-injure yourself. I know that sounds pretty basic, but I didn't know. It's, you know.
Yeah. Just having that guidance. Right. With the Therapeutic Alliance.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, exercise for me is not recreational.
Yeah.
It never has been. And the thing is you know, in talking to you guys and in talking to people on Twitter, that's one thing that I brought up with Dustin when I did my backstory with him. I had to explain that, like, you guys grew up thinking that sports and gym class and activity was the best thing ever, and you were really good at it, and you got, you know, external validation from that, and you benefited from it health-wise and big time socially, and this is all great for you. And as I said to Dustin in that interview, I said, you know, gym class nearly destroyed my will to live. Because I was always the last picked for kickball. You know, so what you're seeing in the dynamic for somebody, especially somebody that's never been, you know, usually active in a sports and exercise sort of way. All those kind of patients like me that have never been active in that sense, that have no positive memories about exercise or activity or sports at all, we're now being put in a room of people like you who so much of how they define themselves. And then people are wondering, well, why don't patients comply? Why aren't they compliant? It's because we're living in two different universes. Sports and activity is very positive for most of you, would have to be very positive for most of you. And when I think about sports and exercise, I think about social rejection. I think about social rejection. I think about my body being insufficient to keep up with my peers. Mm-hmm. And the amount of anxiety and fear and sometimes terror that brings up, nobody addresses. And that's why I get really ticked off when people talk about soft skills being soft. Well, you know, if there were soft skills and they're so easy, why are you avoiding them? You know?
You know, this might sound crazy, Lisa, but I haven't learned about that stuff in school. Nobody, there's no class where they sit you down and they talk to Tyler and I and be like, let me tell you how to be empathetic just for someone that hated the shit out of PE and how that's going to affect their mindset when you tell them to go home and do these exercises.
Mm-hmm. Like, I don't exercise with anybody. Like, ever, unless Eric decides to foam roll with me every once in a while, we foam roll together. I don't exercise with anybody. I kind of wish I could sometimes with, you know, people that I'm closer to, like my brothers or sisters, but they're not into it. Or they're into things that I can't do, like running.
Yeah. So, mm-hmm. And where can people find you, Lisa, and reach out to you?
Twitter mostly. I was on Facebook for a while, but I'm not really happy with Zuckerberg, so I got off, deleted my account. Lisa Mac, so LisaMac, the letter N as in Nancy, Cheese, all spelled out normally. So Lisa Mac N Cheese. That's the only social media platform I'm on. Check out Jerry's podcast, episode 19, Healthcare Disruption. That's on his website, jerrydurhampt.com. Check out Senior Rehab Podcast. I believe that was a 2016 interview. It's called Patient Perspective. I want to say it was August of 2016. I'm not sure. Check out Two Nobodies, Culture for Dialogue. That was April of last year, I believe. And then there was an earlier one that Jerry did, but it's escaping me which platform that was on. That one's kind of a dead link, I think. But check out those three for if any of this resonates with you. And maybe if it doesn't, maybe it will. I don't know.
For sure. And Edwin, what about you? Where can people hit you up?
You can find me at Edwin Porras, S-P-T. Porras is P as in Paul, O-R-R-A-S. And I have pretty much anything else I have will be from Twitter. It's usually where I'm at.
Hell yeah. Edwin, Lisa, Eddie. Who else sent us questions?
Josh, oh man,
Josh, Larry. Thank y'all so much for making this episode happen. Larry.
Thank you to you guys. Appreciate it. Sorry for the trains rolling through. You know, you got to get that freight.
We're just glad you're safe, Edwin.
I'm safe.
I work for a shipping company. I play with trains all day long.
Nice.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Thank y'all so much, Lisa. You guys have a great day.
This is fun. We should do this again.
For sure.
Thank you so much, all of you, especially you, Edwin.
Oh, of course. Definitely.